This is AM with Sabra Lane.
Could you live on $40 a day? The answer from one federal Liberal MP is yes. It's called phone spoofing. The scam is hijacking people's phone numbers.
The worst of it, it probably would have been easily 100 phone calls.
In one day?
Yeah. I had one bloke, he rang me up, he threatened to go to the coppers. Don't know that I'd been calling him. My phone number had called him about 25 times or something in a day.
And Australian cricket has a new coach. What will Justin Langer bring to the team? We'll hear from the ABC's Jim Waxwell. Good morning and welcome to AM. First, the hits keep coming for the Commonwealth Bank. Last night, the bank admitted it lost the financial statements of nearly 20 million accounts. The bank realised the breach in 2016, but has only just confessed to the data breach. The bank says two magnetic tapes which contained the data were scheduled for destruction, but it now can't account for the tapes, and following an investigation, it assumes they've been destroyed. With more, I'm joined by our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. And Peter, the bank stresses that customers' pins and passwords are safe, but it says there's no evidence of customers' information being compromised, yet this is pretty embarrassing.
That's right, Sabra. Right now, any single issue, slip-up, mistake or admission from banks, especially the CBA, is big news and amplified given the backdrop of revelations from the Royal Commission and evidence of dodgy, unethical or outright sloppy behaviour. But the pressure's especially acute when it comes to private data of customers, and we're still seeing the fallout from the global company like Facebook, where personal information was acquired by Cambridge Analytica, which is now shut down. But in this particular case, the CBA says there's no evidence of customer information being compromised or suspicious activity, there was no cyber attack, and that monitoring by the CBA suggests that customers don't need to take any action. But clearly, when names, addresses, account details are involved, customers are quite rightly asking why they weren't told much earlier. Now, I just spoke with the CBA's acting head of retail banking, Angus Sullivan, who says there was no disclosure, even though the CBA can't be 100% sure the data was destroyed.
We immediately launched an investigation to understand what had happened. And during the course of that, we've been unable to assure ourselves that the documents or the drives have been destroyed, but the investigation that we undertook indicates that the most likely outcome is that they in fact were.
So just to be clear, you're not totally convinced that the drives were destroyed?
That's correct. You know, we don't have the documentation that we would like to be able to evidence their destruction, and there's nothing to indicate from that monitoring from that date to now that the data connected with those tapes has made its way into a malicious party's hand and converted itself into fraud or bad behaviour on customer accounts.
But you can't be 100% sure that that information hasn't got to parties who might misuse it.
That's correct. It seems very unlikely, but we can't be 100% sure.
But given that you're not 100% convinced that this data has been destroyed, didn't customers have a right to know that it might be out there?
Look, we gave a lot of consideration to that at the time. Obviously, it was foremost in our minds. We made a decision on balance that given that the most likely outcome was that the materials had been destroyed, that it wasn't appropriate to notify customers.
Commonwealth Bank's acting head of retail banking, Angus Sullivan, speaking there with Peter Ryan. And Peter, has the bank given you a clear explanation why it didn't come up front about this in 2016?
Well, the CBA has said that they took this matter to the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner and the banking regulator, APRA. There was a briefing about the CBA's investigation. A decision was made by the CBA not to notify customers, as we heard, because monitoring was in place. They also had an external forensic investigation by the advice firm KPMG. But as we heard then, the CBA is satisfied the information was destroyed, though not 100%. They may have been satisfied, but customers perhaps should have been warned, even though the CBA has now advised this issue to the Australian Stock Exchange in an announcement. But the matter of full and continuous disclosure is something that the corporate regulator ASIC is already investigating in another matter relating to the CBA, allegations that the bank allegedly breached anti-money laundering laws on around 54,000 times, and whether or not investors in that case had been properly informed.
Now, this comes after the regulator APRA's report earlier this week. It was scathing of CBA. It said that the bank had been complacent. Is this perhaps just another example of that?
Well, the timing's certainly very bad for the CBA, given those APRA criticisms, widespread complacency, dulled senses, unclear accountabilities, inadequate oversight by an overly bureaucratic institution. The CBA's new CEO, Matt Comyn, who I spoke to earlier this week, has pledged to turn the CBA around and to change the culture. But, of course, his job is now just a bit more harder as he tries to convince customers that this wasn't more complacency or sloppy behaviour.
Senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. The latest blunder couldn't have come as a worse time, as we've just mentioned, for the banking sector, as revelations of incompetence and misconduct seem to mount daily. Many customers say their confidence in banks is at an all-time low. Jonathan Hare reports.
The bad news hasn't stopped in recent weeks for Commonwealth Bank customers, and many, such as Belinda, are losing their patience.
This has just been an example of why my trust was, responsibly removed. It's disappointing. I'm a long-term customer of the Commonwealth. I've stuck with them through thick and thin, but this is extremely thin.
And Belinda is thinking of switching banks.
Loyalty doesn't go very far these days. I think that losing records, that's a type of disloyalty to me, isn't it? In terms of I put my trust in them to retain my details, to do the right thing with those. If I did this in my line of work, I would have lost my job.
The CBA's problems are compounding, almost on a daily basis. It's not a surprise to people like Jeff Morris, a longtime critic of the Commonwealth Bank. After working for them in 2008, he blew the whistle on the institution several times.
I must say, even I'm staggered. It's just like another Commonwealth Bank scandal. I mean, everything that can go wrong has gone wrong.
He didn't think he could be shocked by banking scandals anymore. He now says he was wrong.
I guess it's just another reflection of an organisation that was focused on cutting what were regarded as unnecessary costs to the bone. So it's the sort of thing that leads to these sort of problems. They cut back on what they regard as being just unnecessary costs like compliance and security and so forth.
Jeff Shannon runs a website called Unhappy Banking, which publishes complaints about various banks.
It's appalling what's happened, but it's not surprising because Narev was just like he ran it with an iron fist and he didn't care about the customers. All he cared about was profit, and they forgot what makes them the profit, and that's the customers.
Senior banking analyst Brett Lemesre from Shaw and Partners says CBA should have let its customers know about the incident years ago.
I think it's ridiculous that they wait until the story is broken by the media before they make some comment. They should have alerted all their customers so the customers could watch their own accounts carefully and not just rely on Commonwealth Bank watching them. Not only is it a problem that they haven't kept their customers up to date, but it shows another problem in the systems that they have, lack of accountability and willingness to come clean. We want to make sure that this is the end of the road for the problems. Hopefully that's the case, but we wait and see.
Senior banking analyst Brett Lemesre and Jonathan Hare and Sarah Sedgie with that report. The Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen says the federal government and the Information Commissioner need to explain to people about what they knew about the breach and when and why it's taken years for people to find out about it. On AM yesterday, we asked if you could live off $40 a day. That's the amount of the new start allowance, which hasn't gone up in real terms in 25 years. One federal politician, Liberal MP Julia Banks, says she could survive on that amount each day. AM has asked someone who is a welfare recipient about how easy or difficult daily life is, and she's challenging Julia Banks to walk a mile in her shoes. Tom Eagledon filed this report.
Never had to worry about whether or not you can get something as simple as toilet paper, then you're not going to know what it's like.
That's 22-year-old Sherry Prendergast. She's been on the youth allowance for 6 years, worth $400 a fortnight.
If you make more money than what people on Newstart are getting, I'd challenge people to do it, see what it feels like.
Federal Liberal backbencher Julia Banks says she could do it. She spoke to ABC Melbourne radio presenter Raphael Epstein last night.
Could you live on $40 a day?
I could live on $40 a day, knowing that the government is supporting me with Newstart to look for employment.
That boast lit up the talkback line.
I find find is completely insulting, actually.
I think she's totally out of touch.
I'm certainly not. I speak to constituents every day, and all I can say is the dignity of having a job and finding work is what our policy is about.
Hobart-based Sherry Prendergast has been looking for a job. She's attained certificates in business management and first aid, and she's getting her responsible service of alcohol ticket, as well as volunteering with a homelessness service, but to no avail. She says, though, she's lucky compared to others. She lives with her sister, who charges her just $100 a week rent, but that's half of Sherry's income, and life between fortnightly welfare payments is precarious.
The first week you're fine. You normally have enough to do what you need to do, but the second week is usually like hell.
Shopping comes first. She buys just enough food to last a fortnight. After that, it's decision time, like if she can afford credit for her prepaid phone.
You have to pre-plan if you need to get credit. And if something shows up out of nowhere, like a job interview or something like that, if you haven't organised for that, you can't do it. It's just out of the question.
Then there's medical bills.
I have anxiety and depression, and I'm medicated for both of them. And I've definitely had weeks and months where I haven't been able to afford it. I also have asthma, and I've had to go without Ventolin because I haven't had the money that fortnight.
And she thinks it'd be good if politicians like Julia Banks had a better understanding of what that's like.
It kind of makes me wonder, when was the last time that she was living off of $400 a fortnight?
Do you reckon she should put her money where her mouth is and try?
I reckon she could give it a go.
How do you reckon she'd go?
I'm not sure, really. I kind of hope that someone in that kind of a position really does learn what it's like.
That's welfare recipient Sherry Prendergast ending Tom Eagledon's report. And as we mentioned earlier in the show, Cambridge Analytica, the data firm at the centre of Facebook's privacy scandal, is shutting down effective immediately, and it's starting bankruptcy proceedings. The company says it's been vilified for actions it claims are legal and widely accepted as part of online advertising. Connie Aegis reports.
Cambridge Analytica made headlines for improperly obtaining personal information of millions of people on behalf of political clients. Now they're shutting down and filing for bankruptcy. Professor Nigel Fair from UNSW Cyber isn't surprised.
They've been under a lot of heat in the last, let's call it, couple of months, and they're damaged goods now, and no one will be using them.
Up to 87 million Facebook users were harvested by applications, with 53 Australians directly caught up in the scandal. Not to mention many more of their friends who inadvertently were affected. Cambridge Analytica say it's been vilified and claim their actions are legal and widely accepted as part of online advertising.
It's part of online advertising, but it's definitely not widely accepted. I think a lot of the issue here is exactly what they've done with the data without the consent or the knowing consent of the users. And that's really the nub of this matter, is people haven't been informed about what their data was used for.
There are many other data mining companies that do the same work as Cambridge Analytica.
I think there's quite a few other data analytic companies out there that are doing exactly the same thing. They just haven't had the public exposure that Cambridge Analytica have in this instance. So they might be sitting back and a little bit quiet and not doing so much work at the moment.
Facebook say the announcement will not stop their investigation into the matter. They want to understand what happened and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Connie Aegis reporting there. You're listening to AM and it's 13 minutes past 8. A gangster autocracy. That's Robert E. Kelly's view of North Korea. He's a professor from the Department of Political Science and Diplomacy at Pusan University in South Korea. You might remember Professor Kelly. He and his family became internet stars over a year ago when his two children and wife gradually and accidentally gate-crashed a live interview with the BBC. That became a viral sensation. He is in Australia as a guest of the Lowy Institute, and he joins us now. Good morning and welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Professor Kelly, you were pessimistic about the Korean summit last Friday. How surprised are you by what actually happened?
Not very. The biggest concern is always, and has been with the North Koreans for many years, the details of projects and agreements and deals. We need to get to implementation and move beyond statements of principle. We've had four or five of these sorts of statements in the last 30 or 40 years with the North Koreans, and I think it was something of a disappointment that given that history, the South Korean government was unable to get the North Koreans to agree to more because basically all we did last week was reaffirm where we stood, which was that national reconciliation is good and unification is good and war is bad and things like that. And we, what still really matters, what everybody is still waiting for, is the details on what the North Koreans specifically will do to denuclearize and reduce tensions.
Do you trust Kim Jong-un? I mean, this promise to give up his nuclear weapons program in exchange for the U.S. committing to formally end the war?
No, and we shouldn't. I mean, at this point, really, nobody really should trust the North Koreans. We really should insist on pretty significant, pretty stringent verification protocols. It would be something like, ideally, I think something like the Iran deal, where North Korea is pulled back into the International Atomic Energy Agency. We have cameras in there, verification. International neutral teams go up and look at sites. I think this would be pretty tough for the North Koreans. They've generally shied away from these kinds of things in the past. They've really been uncomfortable with foreign inspectors. But it's going to have to be, the verification protocols are going to have to be pretty stringent.
Some of Donald Trump's critics claim that he's been played by North Korea. Others say that he should be nominated for a peace prize. What do you think?
It's probably in the middle. No, I don't think the president deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. I don't actually think that the maximum pressure campaign really resulted in this opening. I think this is because the North Koreans now feel that they have nuclear deterrence with the United States, which is to say they can strike the United States with a nuclear weapon. That means America cannot attack North Korea because, you know, they might nuke us in return, and therefore that gives North Korea room to negotiate. I think that's what this sort of spring of symmetry is, you know, because the North Koreans are not just meeting with the Americans, but the South Koreans with the Chinese, probably the Japanese and the Russians, them at the IOC. And what they're doing basically, to my mind, is shopping around the program. So I don't think that they're coming to the table to capitulate, as the president has intimated. I think they're coming basically looking for a deal. And if we don't give them something, if we don't get some kind of deal out of them, they'll just go back to the defensive crouch they've been in for years.
You've been pessimistic about the prospect of the North Koreans giving up their weapons. What comes first, sanctions relief or evidence of dismantling the program?
Yeah, that's actually sort of the big, you're getting right to the heart of the issue, right? I mean, sequencing has always been a really big problem with the North Koreans too, right? So we get to these deals and then the question becomes sort of who goes first. That's one of the reasons why it would be nice to have an international monitor so that it wasn't quite such a zero-sum game with the two, sort of the Americans and the North Koreans, going sort of eyeball to eyeball over every detail and every codicil in a treaty or something like that. But ultimately, yeah, there's going to have to be some kind of agreed sequencing of who goes first and how it's going to get verified. My sense is at this point it would be the president is more like, this president particularly is probably going to insist that the North Koreans go first on some stuff. It won't be complete. The North Koreans are not going to denuclearize in like 6 months. They're going to tell us it's going to take 10 years or 12 years, and they're going to ask for, you know, $50 billion to do it. My sense is the North Koreans could maybe make a gesture of good faith to the president by maybe giving up like two or three warheads or some missiles or something like that in the next 6 months to 8 months. That would help convince the international community that the North Koreans really mean it. Because if they don't, then we kind of get back to where we've always been in the past, right, which is kind of back and forth sort of food fight over who should move first. And then it kind of, then the agreements kind of dissipate. They kind of break up.
Last week, you said that the idea of a summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump was wrong, that the U.S. actually gave away too much by agreeing to meet. Do you still feel that same way?
That's correct. Yes, I do. The North Koreans benefit a lot from meeting the American president. You know, the president, Donald Trump is incorrect when he says that it's sort of amazing that he's like the first president to meet North Korea. The North Koreans wanted to meet American presidents for decades. I mean, if any previous American president wanted to meet the Kim family, it was really never very difficult. I mean, all they did was say yes. The thing is, no American president previous to this one wanted to, because when you meet the president, the leader of the free world, as a gangster dictator like the Kim family, I mean, you're according them legitimacy. The meeting when Donald Trump shakes Kim Jong-un's hand, that's going to run on North Korean TV on loop for the next 25 years because it legitimates North Korea as a real country, not as some weird, backward, feudal gangster piece of Korea that's sort of, you know, the crazy uncle in the attic. It's going to actually make North Korea into like a genuine, legitimate state. That's the whole reason why no American president has ever met the North Koreans. I mean, this is actually well established out there in the analyst community, and this is what I'm concerned about. The president didn't know this because he doesn't read his briefing notes. He doesn't, bone up on this stuff as he needs to, and I'm very concerned that when he meets Kim Jong-un, who knows what else he's going to offer. We should not have given them the meeting for free. That was a huge error, in my opinion.
What would be a measure of success in your mind from that coming meeting between Mr. Trump and Kim Jong-un?
At the minimum, some kind of cap or limit on what the North Koreans have, specifically on missiles and nukes. Like how many warheads do they have, and they're going to limit them at that. You know, I don't know, like 50, 100, whatever they have, and missiles. You know, again, we just don't know how many they have. What their ranges are. At the minimum, there have to be caps where they get sort of frozen where they are now. So so the program doesn't get even worse. And then in 2025, you and I are talking about the North Koreans with 500 ICBMs or something. And then ideally, some kind of rollback in which you actually get inspectors to go up there and we actually watch the North Koreans saw in half, blow torches, the missiles or something like that. We've done this with the Soviets. We did this with the Russians after the Cold War, right? We could actually watch the inspectors go and, cut the planes in half and stuff. And that would be, that's what everybody wants. It's just, I just don't know if the president can get to that.
Professor Kelly, thank you so much for joining AM this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Australia's race for space will receive a $50 million kickstart in next week's budget. AM can reveal the funding will help set up a new agency, while states will be invited to compete to host the headquarters and launch sites for satellites. Defence reporter Andrew Green has the story.
2-1-0. All engines running.
Back in 1969, Australia played a crucial role helping to beam the historic moon landing mission to the world. Now, almost half a century on, this country's about to get its first dedicated space agency. Dr. Brad Tucker is an astrophysicist at the Australian National University.
I think it's overdue since the 60s with the launch of the first satellite. And Australia was one of the first countries to get into the business. And it's now great to hear that the Australian government is paying attention.
AM has learnt next week's federal budget will include a $50 million seed funding package to establish the Australian Space Agency. The Turnbull government is yet to decide where it'll be located, but it's understood Western Australia, South Australia, the Northern Territory and the ACT have all expressed interest in hosting the headquarters. Professor Anna Moore is a member of an expert reference group which has just completed a report for the government on the Australian space industry's capability to take part in a global market.
The $50 million injection is a great start for setting up the agency itself. We're talking about setting up the administration, the legal aspects, working across government.
AM can also reveal former CSIRO boss Dr. Megan Clark, who led the government's review, will head the new space agency for its first year. AM has confirmed the budget will also have a focus on improving GPS technology, which can be used for mapping, aviation and broad-scale farming projects. But a senior coalition source says the government expects the private sector will contribute the lion's share of funding for Australia's space industry, a sector which globally is thought to be worth more than $400 billion a year.
We're talking here about national level projects, bigger projects, and I think you need to co-invest here. You can't expect everything from industry, it has to be a co-invest.
And that's Professor Anna Moore ending Andrew Green's report. Imagine if your phone number was hijacked by scammers and it started ringing day and night. It's happening to mobiles and landlines in Australia, and it's taking a particular toll on some people in regional and rural Australia. Rachel Carbonell reports.
Hello.
Joy, which isn't her real name, she doesn't want to be identified, is a 69-year-old woman who lives alone in a small rural town in Victoria. She has no mobile or internet, and she's had the same landline number for 30 years. Recently, she started receiving calls from people all over Australia, all saying that they'd received a call or a text from her number.
Well, I had 21 a day and probably average of 5 a day.
She's had to switch off her message bank.
Because I was getting some terrible messages left on them when I wasn't home. Got a couple of swear words.
The barrage of calls has left Joy feeling anxious and upset.
I don't want to answer the phone and I've not eaten much. If I get a phone call, I never let on them by myself.
Professor of Cybersecurity at Sunshine Coast University, Dave Lacey, says it's more than likely Joy's number has been spoofed by a phone scammer.
Phone spoofing is essentially where someone looks to make a phone call but disguise the number.
Scammers do this by hijacking phone numbers, either to imitate a person or a business or a government department, or to appear like a local or legitimate number to increase their chances of getting through to their victim. In this case, it appears scammers have randomly picked Joy's number. And she's not the only one. Ethan Fitzgerald recently bought a steel and engineering business in Wangaratta in Victoria's northeast. Last month, he too started getting hundreds of phone calls.
The worst of it probably would have been easily 100 phone calls.
In one day?
Yeah. I had one bloke, he rang me up and he goes, oh, you threatened to go to the coppers. Because apparently I don't know that I'd been calling him, but yeah, my phone number had called him about 25 times or something in a day.
Cybersecurity expert Professor Dave Lacey is also the founder of charity ID Care, a national crisis line for people experiencing identity cybercrime. He says Joy and Ethan have probably been caught up in an illegal international phone scam.
I think their landline number has been deliberately stolen by a transnational crime syndicate so that when they make phone calls to scam Australians, the phone number that they look as though they're calling from is actually another victim in the country who might be a small business or a community member. And as a result of that, that community member or small business is starting to receive many calls from Australians who quite rightly are fed up with transnational organised crime calling their number. There would not be a week that goes by where we don't have a member of the community in regional Australia that says, I just simply refuse to answer my landline now.
Some businesses use spoofing for legitimate reasons, such as providing a central number to call back when phoning from call centres. But that clearly isn't the case here. Fraudulent phone spoofing isn't regulated by one body or law.
So what we've found in this whole landscape is that there's no shortage of organisations in government or indeed industry that have a stake. The challenge that we find is that there does not appear to be one absolute owner of that problem.
That's Professor Dave Lacey from the Sunshine Coast University, ending that report from Rachel Carbonell. The Australian men's cricket team has a new coach. It's Justin Langer. He's the current coach for the West Australian team. The 47-year-old replaces Darren Lehman, who stepped down following the ball tampering scandal in South Africa. Langer had a stellar career as a player, including 105 test matches for Australia. Earlier, I spoke with the ABC's cricket commentator Jim Maxwell about the new coach.
Well, no surprise, he's been pretty much earmarked for this role ever since it was revealed some time ago that Lehman's contract was going to run out after the Ashes next year. And I think everyone thought that he was a shoe-in for the job, given that he's been on the periphery of it and has had a great success over in the West in four-day and one-day cricket and in T20 as well. That's probably been the most remarkable part of it. But the interesting idea Cricket Australia have come up with seems to be embrace all three forms of the game under one coach rather than split it up as they looked like they were going to do when they had Ricky Ponting looking after the T20 team.
Now, he'll have to see the rebranding of the team following the ball tampering scandal and, you know, he'll have to craft the team without Steve Smith and David Warner. How big a task has he got?
He's got a huge task because, as we saw in South Africa, even with Smith and Warner playing, Australia's batting was at best vulnerable, mainly brittle. And that part of Australia's cricket is going to have to be restored somehow. And at the moment, a lot of the punditry, even the selectors, would look around and say, well, who is going to fill the spots of those two and Bancroft in the short term? Assuming that they come back, well, at least Smith and Bancroft. So there's some issues there. The bowling seems to be less of an issue other than fast bowlers breaking down and who knows what's going to happen with Cummins and Stark a longer term, whether they'll be able to stand up to the rigours of getting through various series, particularly India and then Sri Lanka next summer. So there's a lot of uncertainty, instability about the structure of Australia's team. Even given what's happened recently, affecting their morale, with Tim Payne having to be thrown into the job, and you know, with all of us wondering how Australia can kind of restore its mojo after that appalling lack of judgment in South Africa.
Now, he walked away from Test cricket as a player more than a decade ago. What will Justin Langer bring to this role?
Well, he's a very determined and hungry cricketer. And as a coach, I think he tried to make sure that everybody commits to the team ethic, the team culture concept, whatever, of working with each other to get the best result. And I think there's a thoroughness and attention to detail that it could be almost overwhelming for some of the players. I hope it doesn't get too intense. But I think he's going to bring a better style, psychology to the business of managing the team. And in effect, that's what a coach is doing, I suppose, in his mentor role these days, and getting the best out of the players.
That's the ABC's cricket commentator Jim Maxwell. Checking finance now. Stocks on Wall Street rose briefly overnight but returned to negative territory after the US Federal Reserve left interest rates unchanged. The Australian dollar is trading at around 74.88 US cents. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane. It is 8:30.